You know ID in the D in the L day. ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID in the D in the L day. ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 205 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino.
And again, we are coming to you from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
All right, well, should we get into what we're drinking this week?
Yep.
I, earlier this evening, hit up, we're going to talk about them in a second here, as we go over the finalized PeltonCast inaugural Hall of Fame class, our friends at Loretta's Tavern, and was able to get a growler fill of, I went with 9-pound porter from Georgetown Brewing, since I had never had that before. I wanted to give that a shot. It's not maybe ideal for this warm weather, but it's very drinkable. So it's quite good.
That's good. I also have a beer from our good friends at Georgetown Brewing. I have got Bodhisattva,
which is what I was planning to drink before I came up with this. So we could have both been drinking Bodhi.
Well, we're both drinking Georgetown.
Definitely over-poured the bottle. So as has become tradition, should start out with the virtual toast here to everybody on the front lines dealing with the novel coronavirus, medical workers in particular helping to keep us safe and allow us to stay home and continue to record this podcast. So we're pouring some sad news earlier this morning as we learned Monday morning that one-time Seahawks starting quarterback and longtime backup to Russell Wilson, Tavares Jackson, died Sunday at age 36 in a car accident in his native Alabama. Jackson started 15 games for the Seahawks in 2011 and then saw action in 8 games after returning from 2013 to 2015, where he was most famous for his role in winning the most important coin toss in franchise history during the NFC Championship game against the Packers. Seahawks got the ball first in that game, scored a Jermaine Kearse touchdown, and then the Super Bowl was canceled.
And really devastating news to hear and to wake up to on your Monday morning at a time when most of the news isn't great. Definitely shocked to see this one, and sad for Tavares and his former teammates and his family.
Jackson did not play in the NFL again after last playing for the Seahawks, but had spent the last two seasons coaching in college, most recently as the quarterback coach at FCS school, Tennessee State. So obviously taken from us far too young. Here's Pete Carroll on Twitter. Tavares Jackson was a beloved teammate, competitor, and Seahawk. He will be deeply missed. So heartbroken by the news of his passing and sending our condolences to his family and friends. We love you forever. All right, well, in happier news, as I alluded to earlier, it is time for us to complete the inaugural class, the 2020 class, for the PeltonCast Hall of Fame, presented by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci is as smooth as they come. And so is our final nominee for the PeltonCast Hall of Fame 2020 inaugural class.
I would say a bit of an upset. I thought that Jermaine Kearse was easily going to take this, given the number of Seahawks fans among the listener, given the fact that he probably is more closely associated with the Pelton cast. But instead, it was Brandon Roy, the UW legend, who went on to play for our semi-hometown Portland Trail Blazers for the bulk of his all-too-brief NBA career, who won the voting quite comfortably, getting about half the vote. About 40% for Jermaine Kearse, and a pretty distant third for Griffey Baseball for SNS.
Jermaine Kearse will have to wait until 2021, which he will be on the ballot again. This time, though, goes to maybe the greatest Washington Husky basketball player in a year that we're talking about, 2005 here, maybe the greatest player we've ever watched at the University of Washington play basketball.
Yeah, I mean, certainly within our lifetimes, no one I don't think has come. I mean, Christian Velp, first off, was not someone we watched in college. Todd McCullough was great, but nobody has gotten to the level, probably since, at the very least, Bob Hubrig's in the 50s, if ever, that Brandon Roy reached during that 2005-06 season, where, you know, I think a pretty strong case could be made that he was the third best player in the country at worst, behind Adam Morrison and J.J. Redick, who got a lot more of the attention.
Oh, man. 2005 was a wild time.
That's one of my favorite college basketball seasons. Those back-to-back seasons. The next year was the Durant-Oden season. So that was a fun time for college basketball.
I do feel like college basketball, it didn't peak, obviously, but like in our lifetime's peak, maybe of the 2000s, that was the best time period of college basketball.
Yeah. So let's talk about Brandon Roy. I mean, this guy, as Northwest as they come, you know, spent his entire childhood growing up in the Seattle area, went to middle school in what Wallingford, at the middle school that we used to shoot baskets at when the famous Cousin Katie and I lived there.
What school is that? Meany, is that right?
I forget what the name of it is. But I remember reading that there was like an Oregon Live story about him when he was in the All-Star game in 2008. And I remember reading that during the All-Star game and being like, wait, I remember that school.
Didn't you see him playing there one time?
No.
Oh, I thought you saw him playing one time.
No, that would be a really notable story. I would tell that all the time. Goes to Garfield High School, follows his older brother, Ed Roy, was, you know, a part is, I guess that would have been a sophomore of this Garfield team that, you know, did not win the state championship, in part because he came up short in the closing minutes, but is one of the best remembered high school basketball teams in Washington State history. They had they were called the Two Roys. And neither of them was Brandon Roy. It was his older brother, Ed, who, you know, was similarly talented but was unable to ever make it to college. And then Roy Del Smiley, who I'm pretty sure played at USC eventually. And for a while, it looked like Brandon Roy might follow his brother down that same path of not capitalizing on his basketball talent. He flirted with declaring for the NBA draft directly out of high school because of the fact that he hadn't qualified to get into UW. Then was unable to play, was not, you know, part of the roster for the fall quarter part of his freshman season because of, you know, an SAT score that wasn't admitted. You know, there's been a lot of stories that have been written about this, including the biography that Dan Rayleigh did of Brandon Roy. He was working as a dock worker at the Port of Seattle while he was, you know, waiting to find out whether he would get into UW. And then he finally does and makes his debut during Pac-12 play against Wazoo, a game that I was at and not very many other people were at. Because that was kind of the point that UW basketball was in then, still in the last year of the I guess that was the first year of the Lorenzo Romar era. But it hadn't really taken off by that point. And then he's there for the entire transformation. We're going to talk about the Huskies getting the number one seed in 2005, getting back to the tournament the year before that, and then reaching the Sweet 16 each of his last 2 years at UW with him as the driving force as a senior. You can jump. Feel free to jump in here anytime.
I'm dealing with a child who's crying right now. This is the Zoom meetings of Pelton Casts. It is ironic that thinking back to him not potentially not being eligible, because to me, maybe more than almost any college player that we've witnessed, I suppose there have been a couple others in UW history, he benefited from being at UW for as many seasons as he was, growing just incrementally every single year. You know, the team that we talked about last week that came alive midway through the season, he was good on that team, but he was not by any means the focal point of that offense. And
well, part of what happened is, you know, in the fall he was injured during the non-conference tournament the Huskies played, or I guess it was even before that, because he didn't make his season debut until the day before Christmas. And then the Huskies were going so well at the point that they just brought him off the bench basically the entire season. Which is wild. He's a junior.
I mean, somebody who just kept getting better and better and better throughout his entire career at UW until he reached the point as a senior where you know, like we discussed, the showdown, this is actually in 2000, I guess this was in 2005,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was in 2005, yeah.
In 2005, being at the game that he played against Gonzaga at Heck Ed was the best college basketball game I've ever been at, you know?
Makes sense.
And
also still the last time you'd have beat Gonzaga, right?
Really? No, I think
so.
There was that, and then there was a game later that year where he played against Arizona, and it was him and Hot Sauce going against each other, Hassan Adams.
Adam Morrison had 43 points in that game. Do you know how many points Brandon Roy actually scored in that Gonzaga game?
How many?
10.
What?
He wasn't even the Muskie's best player in that game. See, that's one of those tricks that memory plays on you. Jamal Williams was really the go-to guy in that game with 22 points and 10 and 16 shooting.
It was more that Arizona game. The Arizona game that year, this is how fucking terrible college basketball is. Because this must have never happened in his entire career.
You're thinking that this is 04-05, the year that he fouled out in overtime.
That he hits the three to send it to overtime, and then hit another three to send it to double overtime, right? And then fouled out after that. It was just like, Brandon Roy should never foul out of a game. I'm sorry, there's no player who fouls less than Brandon Roy. Like, I guarantee he probably fouled out one time in his entire NBA career, if that.
All right, I'm having to do a lot of play indexing now.
But like,
give me a second here.
But Brandon Roy, that season, what he was able to accomplish, and put the team on his back that year after a lot of the players who were part of this run the previous season worked on, you know, it was still a fairly deep team, but like it was Brandon Roy's team by that next year, on a team that I think we all agree, if it weren't for a stupid Mike Jensen foul and maybe some lucky
or the technical foul on Brandon Roy.
Oh, the double
he fouled out of that game.
Rudy Gay, where they got it. God, I hate college basketball. College basketball really deprived us of some great Brandon Roy moments. The number one point, this is not even about Brandon Roy anymore. The number one point of sports should be wanting to keep the best players on the court. And they call it double tech when he and Rudy Gay are tangled up with each other, which counts as a personal foul for some reason in college. And, oh, God. And then I think
Brandon Roy fouled out of three games in the NBA, although two of those he had played at least 44 minutes.
Just awful. Awful that they deprived us of that.
Yeah, I agree.
But Brandon Roy, most importantly, watching him as a basketball player, especially once he'd sort of reached full potential, was...
That was the 2005-06 season, the Arizona game. So I stand corrected on that.
I remember them being the same year. He was unlike any other basketball player we've seen. The only other one who... I was trying to think of an NBA comp for him now, and I feel like Luka Doncic is the only other one.
Yeah, there's certainly elements of that. I thought College Harden was a lot like Brandon Roy. He's evolved beyond that in the NBA.
But also just like that he doesn't play like Brandon Roy plays anymore. Everything that Harden does is jerky. Like, and it's jerky in every way. But the way that he would move with the ball was just so fluid. Like, when people talk about basketball being like jazz, right? Like, they talk about it's like such a like fluid sport, right? Like, that is Brandon Roy. He's what people are talking about when they describe the sport that way. And that's how he played basketball. He played basketball like jazz music.
So then Roy, after he leaves UW, gets drafted by the Blazers, is there a couple of seasons before the Sonics move. And, you know, his presence, along with Nate McMillan being Mr. Sonic being the coach in Portland, you've mentioned this, made it so much easier to, like, follow the Blazers right from the jump.
Oh, it was set up perfectly for us, right? Like, for the city of Seattle, they could not have been set up better for if the Sonics were going to move, having a more natural place for us to jump to, obviously being the closest city, but like we already kind of liked the Blazers before then. I think I had a Brandon Roy shirt, and they had Martell Webster at the time, who we still liked. Like,
yep.
You
say that as if we don't like Martell. I mean, you know, well, I don't know when the last time was I thought about Martell Webster, but Martell Webster is still great.
I meant we still liked, as like he didn't go to UW and chose to go to the NBA.
I see, yes.
But we still liked him with the Blazers, and like, they were a fun team to watch, and that draft class, I mean, all the talk, because it was the first year that there weren't high school players, that draft class was that it was a terrible draft class or whatever.
I mean, and if you look at the top 10 picks, but there's a lot of busts in there.
The haul that the Blazers made out with LaMarcus Aldridge.
They got
Aldridge
the two best players in the draft.
And Brandon Roy that year. Like, they set themselves up with that draft class. And I consider the Blazers still being on the same run that they were on then. Obviously, you know, the names are different or whatever, but they have really gotten bad since then.
Yeah, I mean, they had the couple of lottery seasons, one of which, I mean, it wasn't specifically with their pick, but resulted in Damian Lillard, and that, you know, set up the second run that they've had here for a number of years. I mean, the one downside of Roy as an NBA prospect, and Chad Ford and Bill Simmons talked about it in a fun podcast they did today on Chad's new NBA Big Board podcast, it was his knees. Like, the medicals were very clear that the knee surgeries he had had, how quickly he had come back, first in high school, and then that surgery he suffered as a junior that he only missed 3 weeks. He was injured in that Great Alaska Shootout, which we'll talk about in a second here. That set him up long-term for trouble with his knees, and it eventually kicked in after he was awesome for a period of time. You know, maybe the NBA's second best shooting guard in that span after, you know, after Kobe Bryant. But by 2010-11, when he is age 26, should really be coming into his prime, you know, is limited to 47 games, comes off the bench in more than half of those, 12.2 points per game. Although that year did yield the last great Brandon Roy moment, one of my all-time favorite basketball games ever to cover and attend. Game 4 against Dallas. He's been coming off the bench. He's been frustrated with his role, and the Blazers are about to go down 3-1 at home. They're trailing badly in the second half, and then all of a sudden Roy comes up huge in the fourth quarter, hitting shot after shot to put them ahead and win that game on the day before Easter. And ESPN didn't have anyone there. This was back before I was actually working for ESPN, but I had done some freelance work for them for ESPN Insider at that point. And so my editor now reached out to me and said, hey, you know, you got this game, would you like to write about it? And I ended up writing the lead story for the Daily Dime on the site the next day about Brandon Roy leading this Blazers comeback.
Wow, there you go. Yeah. Just as Brandon Roy was leaving his prime, you were coming into your own.
Well, prime is generous. So that turns out to be Brandon Roy plays only one more game in the city of Portland.
Wow.
The lockout followed that. After that, they choose to amnesty him. Roy announces his retirement, subsequently tries to make a comeback the following summer with the Timberwolves. I remember going to watch him play at the Garfield Community Center, which was where the crossover was way back then, before they moved it to SPU. And Roy playing in that, and the excitement about just seeing him play basketball, and be like, well, it looks pretty good, but it's not quite the same. But again, his knees failed him. He lasted just 5 games in Minnesota. And then the last time we ever saw him in a meaningful role on the basketball court was the Washington alumni game they had that summer of 2013.
I did not realize he only played 5 games in Minnesota.
Yeah, where after that, he told the reporters, myself included, you know, my basketball days are numbered. And it was basically, without saying it, he was announcing his retirement. And that was it for his NBA career. And again, at age, at that point, I guess, still 28.
Pretty wild. I mean, that's part of almost the magic of Brandon Roy, though, is like, he came into the league, he was instantly great. He played a long period of time in college and had these amazing seasons at UW, was instantly the star player of the Blazers ahead of somebody like LaMarcus Aldridge, took them back to the playoffs pretty quickly into his career, and was retired. I mean, he was a 3-time All-Star and retired before he ever hit his prime.
I mean, there's very few cases like this in NBA history. Obviously, you know, not even the greatest what if for the Blazers that era, because they had Greg Oden, who never got to get to that, even that All-Star point that Roy did get a chance to prove that level of talent. But excitingly, Roy has now had the second act as a coach at the local high school level. First at Nathan Hale, when he had the Porter brothers and led them to an undefeated state title. Then moved back to his alma mater, Garfield, led them to a state title the following year. After taking a year sabbatical back on the sidelines this season with a team that wasn't quite at that state champion level, but still very good. And, you know, hopefully many good things in store for Brandon Roy as a coach.
Man, all Brandon Roy does is win small sample size. pretty incredible. Okay, let me ask you a question. Let's say Brandon Roy's knees never get injured, right? Or he has a normal NBA career. Is Brandon Roy an NBA Hall of Famer?
I think when you look at guys who are All-Stars three times by age 25, probably a pretty good percentage of them are Hall of Famers. Like, at least half.
He played four real seasons and made three All-Star teams. He made two All-NBA teams.
I mean, the thing is, we say this. His knees were already a problem. Like, that 2010 season, he had knee surgery at the end of the year. That's when he came back in, like, again in 2 weeks. Because by that point, they were like, well, actually, it turns out you can't do any more damage because there's no more meniscus left for you to tear. It's all gone.
He honestly, even looking at it, played less games than I realized.
Which was also, like, this all-time great moment. Blazers are down, I believe, 2-1 in that series. Yeah, they had won game one and then lost the next two. Got blown out by 48 the next two. Roy comes back on April 24th. His previous game was April 11th, so he'd missed 13 days, including the I don't know when the surgery was in there, presumably the next day, and comes off the bench, gets this huge ovation. Didn't really do that much in that game, but helped buoy the Blazers to a win, although, like all the other playoff series they played in that span, lost in the first round.
What was that game where he hit, like, a 45-foot three?
So that was the first season that I was covering the Blazers, going to games in Portland. And it was the second game I went to. The first one was the opening night on Halloween. They beat the Spurs. And then the second game I went to was a Thursday night TNT game against the Rockets where he hit that game winner.
Man. Well, any person.
I also remember from that season. Oh, yeah. The 52 on December 18th against Phoenix. I was not at that because it was snowing. We were snowed in.
Well, any person who didn't get a chance because his playing career, especially in the NBA, was cut so short, and even in college, and then it happened. You know, there's a whole generation of basketball fans who came after Brandon Roy was out of the NBA. You know, the league took on a different personality in the 2010s, and any person who didn't get the chance to watch him play, it's a real loss because as a basketball player, you know, we talked about growing up with Kevin Payton, and I feel like Brandon Roy, as unique and as exciting of a player to watch in a completely different way. And it's unfortunate that we didn't get to see more of him play. But I do hope that he's definitely gone down as a Husky legend with his number retired in the rafters, definitely gone down as a Pelton Cast Hall of Famer. And I also hope that in Portland, you know, without knowing what the climate is like exactly down there, that he's received just as well in the city of Portland as he is here.
Yeah, Jason Quick had a piece a couple months ago catching up with him, and, you know, I think the consensus was very favorable at that point.
Great.
So he's been eclipsed, unfortunately, by Damian Lillard, who, you know, has been able to stay healthy and have the career that Roy might have had he stayed healthy. But still, you know, I think Roy is seen as the primary guy who got them out of, you know, the bridge from Blazers era to this more successful period extended run, as you mentioned. So the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame inaugural class is complete. To recap it, the direct elect votes: Ken Griffey Jr., Cube 93 FM, Loretta's, Taco Time Northwest, and then you voted in a class of Blue Scholars, Sean Kemp and Gary Payton, Rainier Beer, and Brandon Roy.
Well, I've got another beer here, and that's a Rainier.
Oh, yeah.
To toast crack that open. To the inaugural class of the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. Could not be more proud of of this group of eight electees, inductees. You know, we've really covered a lot of what has made the Pelton Cast what it, you and I and the Pelton Cast, what it is now, and the city of Seattle for the last three decades.
Yep. So I've put together a page for the PeltonCast Hall of Fame that will live on the SonicCentral.com PeltonCast homepage. We'll also tweet out that link, of course, so be sure to check that out.
There we go.
I spent a solid hour on Photoshop trial today making this.
Oh, my God.
It's been a while. It all came back to me, though.
And again, thanks to our sponsor for this, Poliachi. Obvious Hall of Famers in their own right.
Absolutely.
So we will be back next spring with the second class of the PeltonCast Hall of Fame.
Ideally, should there be a blazer associated with this? Can it be like a, I guess, green blazer and gold blazer are both kind
there
of
is
done.
A blazer associated with this.
Wow. Maybe a purple blazer in honor of Lorenzo Aromar. Who
Brandon
could,
Roy is
could
the blazer
be.
Associated with this.
I got the joke.
Okay.
Yes, I
okay.
got the joke. I'm saying Brandon Roy is not a color of blazer.
Okay, what I'm trying to say is he played for the Blazers.
Can you draw me a diagram?
Man, I don't... Purple's a little too Husky-centric.
True, that's fair. I don't know. We'll keep.
I feel like
maybe.
Nobody else
it's electric
green.
Blazer,
right?
No, there's a very.
How do you get one of those?
but no one does an electric, like a neon green, like the Seahawks action green.
A
green
blazer.
I think let's do it. Somebody mock that up. Maybe I'll Photoshop that. But now it's time. Speaking of. Action green, and an exciting time for that organization. Although I guess, were they wearing action green?
I think this was pre-action green.
It was pre-action green. It was Blue Man Group era. Let's remember some years. Let's remember one of the best years in Seattle sports history.
Wow.
2005.
Whoa.
We start with the Seahawks making the Super Bowl.
Oh, I remember that.
Which, of course, technically happened in 2006, but it's part of the 2005 season. The Seahawks lost week one at Jacksonville and were 2-2 before going an 11-game winning streak before losing their season finale at Green Bay on New Year's Eve with Matt Hasselbeck playing only the first half since the Seahawks had already wrapped up the number one seed in the NFC. The previous week on Christmas Eve, they beat the 13-1 Colts with Peyton Manning playing only the first quarter because Indianapolis had locked up the number one
Jim
seed.
Jim Sorgi coming out strong.
Yeah. Sean Alexander was named MVP that season.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, Walter Jones actually deserved it because running backs, even though they probably mattered a little more then, don't matter.
I remember you had a boss who was at the Sonics, right, who was a Steelers fan. I remember there was a story where you were like, oh, Sean Alexander won the MVP, and he responded, of what?
I don't remember that one. That's funny.
We were at that game on Christmas Eve. It's funny because there's so many, like, I remember that Jacksonville game, right? Were we camping when that happened?
Yes, we were camping.
So we listened to that one on the radio, and there were so many games. There's that game at Tampa Bay. That was the season, right? Like early in the year, it might've been week two, three or four, and they struggled the entire game and managed to like pull out a victory at the very, very end. And so the most notable of the regular season games though,
no, they did not play Tampa Bay that season. I don't know what you're thinking.
Oh, is this a different year that I was thinking of?
Yeah, on that one, it must be.
Well, the most notable game of that year, though, this is the right year, right? I'm thinking of the right year, was we were celebrating the Pelton Thanksgiving, the Sunday Thanksgiving. The Giants come to town, and... a crazy game where, like, I'm hosting the Pelton Thanksgiving at my house in Wedgewood because that's where I was living going to UW. And
we've been very excited to talk about the Wedgewood house, a classic academic year.
Are we talking about an 05 or should we wait until 06 to talk about it?
We could do, I mean, a little of both. I feel like it really hit its stride in 06.
A classic. It was spring 06 that things really hit their stride. But like, I paid no attention to the Pelton cast or the Pelton cast to the Pelton Thanksgiving that we were hosting because I was like, Katie, you got this. Who's not even Pelton.
Katie was cooking the turkey, right?
I think so. And was so consumed by that football game against the Giants. It was like,
that was a great game.
Who was the kicker? Oh God.
Lawrence Tynes.
Was that Larry Tynes? I don't think it was.
Oh no, wait, I have the box score up here. I should be able to figure this out. No, it was Jay Feely. Jay Feely.
Jay Feely. And
two of five.
Two, in that he
game.
Only missed three field goals?
Only?
Because I remember him missing like five field goals in that game.
But he missed three consecutive field goals on their last three drives.
My God. Oh.
Wow. That is pretty wild. If let's see. One of them was a 54-yarder in OT. That's not very – that's not that disappointing. A 40-yarder at the end of regulation that would have obviously won the game since it went to overtime. A 54-yarder and then a 45-yarder again in overtime.
There was that Texans game that was on Monday night or Sunday night. You went to this game, right? Week 6 versus the Texans.
That was Sunday
night. It was Sunday night football.
It wasn't a sweep for that
Jan
one.
Had won a contest – where she won tickets to that game and then the option of a Seahawks jersey, Marcus Tubbs, right? And I think it was their first round draft pick that year, maybe the previous year, and or Ray Allen, a Ray Allen jersey. And we went with the Tubbs jersey. That's how hyped people were on Seahawks football in 2005.
It definitely was easier for me to get a Ray Allen jersey than a Marcus Tubbs
still,
jersey.
Still, it would be like right now choosing an LJ Collier jersey over...
Oh, no.
I don't know. We have a lot less sports in Seattle now.
It's true.
It'd be like choosing an LJ Collier jersey over a Ray Allen jersey now. So, okay, they go into the playoffs as the number one seed.
We got to talk about this Colts game a second more, though.
Okay.
There was, like, for some reason... Like, they should have been taking everybody out, or they should have been trying to run the clock, and instead Sean Alexander scored a touchdown at the end of this game, and I was furious about it.
Yeah,
I was complaining
really
about it the entire walk back, because we, like, left immediately after that. You're like, look, you need to calm down. Other people are around and are going to, like, fight with you about this.
We won the game. Michael Boer had a huge pick at the end of the game, right? Or was that big...
Boer?
It was Michael Boer, right? It wasn't Babs. It wasn't big play Babs. Man, our memory for this is kind of going away 15 years later.
No, I think you're thinking of the Miami game that we went to where Boer had the interception.
So. Oh, that was the Miami game earlier in the year. Yeah, so I was going to Highland Community College again, home of Brian Scalabrine. And two times that year, no, I think we bought the Colts tickets, but the Dolphins game we went to, because at Highland Community College, they had like a table set up where they were selling Seahawks tickets for like $10. Do you remember this?
Well, I don't remember going to Highland Community College. No.
Yeah, you were busy getting the president's scholarship to UW.
the Miami game was in 2004.
Okay, so that was when I got the tickets. But yeah, there was a table set up at
because
Highland
you weren't in Highland Community College in 2005.
Oh my
you
God.
Were at UW.
Wow, I'm remembering this terribly. I don't remember some years at all. Well, anyway, in 2004 game. Wait, so
Boer
that,
had a 63-yard touchdown
Boer
return.
Had huge game. That was 2004. Anyway, the Seahawks fan base, this is to illustrate how different the fan base was in the early 2000s versus now. They had a table set up at Highland Community College where they were selling tickets. They just had like a bunch of tickets in a fucking envelope for $10 per ticket. And, you know, they weren't great seats or whatever, but like, it was just, we just walked up and me and my friend were just like, do you want to go to the Seahawks game? And they're like, I don't know, sure. I guess so. And we just walked to the table and bought them. Like, we would buy tickets a month out, right? Like, it was not a difficult activity. And the fan base before 2005 was not the same. This was the year.
People talk about the bandwagon jumpers during the Super Bowl, you know, this current Pete Carroll run? No, this was the year where the bandwagon formed.
The Seahawks became the most important sports team in the city of Seattle in 2005, and that never changed.
Yeah, no, I guess it didn't really, because when they went through a down period of time, all of Seattle sports went through a down period of time, and boy, it's going to be some dark years to remember in a few years here.
Here's what I'll say about this. So the bandwagon first formed in 2005. This was the year that, like, the Seahawks became ubiquitous, right? Like, I think...
I mean, I just... My just memory of this is, like, this is also when I got on Facebook, was early fall, late summer of 2005, before that camping trip.
The Facebook.
And, yes. I fortunately still had my UW email address so I could join. And I all I remember is like, no, no, that I didn't need to go to the 08. There were not that many Cape Heltons at UWashington at .edu back in the day. Now they just changed to like my UW or something. Yeah, I don't know. It's much shorter now. Way fewer letters.
Way
to
too
type.
Convenient for these students.
Back in my day, you had to type the whole thing.
UWashington.edu. Damn it. And we liked it.
And all of a sudden, like, all of my friends from high school are posting about, like, these Seahawks games they're going to. And I'm like, look, I remember back in high school, the Seahawks won the AFC West my senior year of high school. And it was like my best friend and I were the only two people who cared.
Yeah.
That was
it. The only bandwagons, you and John Noage. It's true, though. Like, that's the reality is this is when people started rallying around the team. Like, you could buy season tickets. I think Chris Smith, the season tickets that I have currently, he bought more or less like mid-season, I think, in 2005. He like went to a couple games and then he bought the rest of the season then, and then I think he bought full season tickets in 2006. But like, this was a team that was going to the Super Bowl, and halfway through the year, you could just be like, ah, fuck it, I think I want to go to all these games. Like, the idea of doing that now is absurd.
Yes. Was undefeated at home and winning so many blowouts. So the games I went to that year, the Texans game you mentioned, they won 42-10. That was, I believe, the inaugural Texans team. I went to the San Francisco game in week 14. They won that 41-3. Alex Smith in that game, who was a rookie, the number one overall pick, went 9 of 22 for 77 yards, which is
that's
actually
what I
not
have been
the worst quarterback
game. Because Derek Carr was the pick.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
I said that right. David Carr? David Carr? Which guy, whatever car it is.
One of the cars. When they have the same initial, it's very difficult to keep them straight. And then that Indianapolis game where they beat the 13-1 Colts 28-13, granted, with backups.
Oh, so they comfortably beat the Colts in that game. Huh.
Yeah, the Colts were leading in the first quarter when Peyton Manning played.
I remember that being like a really excellent Christmas Eve because like we went to that game, came back, we were feeling so good about the Seahawks, right?
Yeah. I mean, when the Seahawks play on Christmas Eve, that's going to define how the day is going to go.
They played on Christmas Eve in the Tavares Jackson season. And
that's true. That was not that bad.
No, they lost to the 49ers, and it was like a gentleman's loss.
That's a great way to describe it. That was a good 49ers team. It was a very respectable effort, and you knew that once they got a real quarterback, they were going to be amazing.
And that quarterback's name is Matt Flynn. okay, so
we'll get there.
They get to the playoffs as the number one seed.
Beat the Washington professional football team 20-10 in the division round.
I believe that's led by Mark Brunell, is that right? Or is Todd Collins starting that game?
I think the Todd Collins game was the other one. Yeah, that was Mark Brunell.
All right.
Was that when Joe Gibbs was back as the coach of Washington?
I believe so, yes. I believe that Joe Gibbs was there.
Yes, it was. So, and then the NFC Championship game, a day we've previously talked about.
Repeatedly.
The fact that it was, yeah, also the day where an exciting Sonics win over the Suns, 151-149, and then, or 152-149, and also the late Kobe Bryant's 81-point game happened that same day.
It's 2006, Seahawks, you can't talk about it.
I know, we'll get to it. The Seahawks dominate Carolina in the NFC Championship game, 34-14 to reach their first ever Super Bowl.
So, we get to Ford Field and Super Bowl XL.
The other thing I remember from this period, this was the stretch where it rained for like 35 days
straight.
It
rained for, I swear to God, 40 straight days. We're talking biblical rain in the city of
40
Seattle.
Days and 40 nights.
Depression levels. So that January, we came back from Christmas break to UW, me and Katie, and I determined, oh my God, I
technically it was 27 consecutive days.
That's all.
Yeah,
I determined that I was not going to spend literally any money, and I wasn't gonna. And I think we collectively agreed that we were not going to turn the heat on in the house, and I definitely wasn't going to turn the heat on in my room. Because these are the insane things that you determine when you're, whatever, 18 years old. No, 20 years old.
You were much older than 18.
When you're 20 years old. And I left my heat on accidentally over the entire spring, or the entire, like, winter break in my room. So it was blazing hot. It was like 75 degrees or whatever for like 2 full weeks. And we came back and there's this giant heat bill. And I was like, fuck it. I'm never turning on the heat again. I'm never buying food again. So Katie would have to be like, I'm going to McDonald's. I will get you a 39-cent cheeseburger. And I'm like, Katie, I can't. Out of principle, I cannot eat a 39-cent cheeseburger. I'm just like a fucking just. It was a crazy time. And meanwhile, it is raining for what feels like 40 straight days. I swear it got to 40, but. So deep in the darkest depths of depression, even despite the Seahawks run, because this is Seattle in January. It's wet. It's cold. It's gross. I'm freezing. I can't even get a McDonald's cheeseburger. And on the day of the Super Bowl XL, it is sunny for the first time, I think, that entire year.
No, it was the NFC Championship game. It was sunny. We played basketball.
Did we on the NFC Championship game? I don't know. Yeah. We played basketball the day of the Super Bowl.
During the NFC Championship
game. I think it rained later. But I remember driving. I was driving down to SeaTac from Wedgewood. I drove from SeaTac to Wedgewood and back to Wedgewood. We were barbecuing. We were drinking beers.
We were definitely barbecuing.
We played basketball. Like, it was a sign, right? It was a sign from God that things were going to go well for us in the Super Bowl. I was like, I've seen the sun. I remember driving through that area on I-5 heading south where it's like by like the, you can see the Paramount to your right and there's all the freeways, all the like tunnels going above you. And then you pop out on the other side and the stadiums are right there to your right. And you're like, everything's okay. We've made it through this. It's early February in Seattle. It's never going to be bad again.
And then the Super Bowl was canceled. So the Seahawks lose the Super Bowl to the Steelers 21-10. That's the Steelers with an A, of course.
Because we're not over it.
I got over it when the Seahawks actually won the Super Bowl. But
it's still,
a long
when you watch these calls now, like, you can't not be frustrated.
Yeah.
Like, there's a reality to it. Like, sure, we're over it in the, like, larger sense of the Seahawks. We've moved on, right? Like, the Seahawks have now won a Super Bowl and then had another Super Bowl canceled, weirdly. But
at the end, very end of the game.
It just feels like this team, they didn't get a fair shake in the game, right?
Yep.
I mean, the Seahawks gained 396 yards in this game and scored 10 points. That is unheard of.
So it was 14-10 when a pass to Jeremy Stevens that would have gone down to the 1 yard line was called back for a Sean Locklear hold. The Seahawks ended up in 3rd and 18 from the Pittsburgh 27, which is where Matt Hasselbeck was intercepted and then called for an illegal block on the Steelers run back, giving Pittsburgh the ball at their own 44. Shortly thereafter, Randall L. completed a trick pass to Hines Ward for a 43-yard touchdown, and that produced the final margin.
Still haunts me. The penalty on Hasselbeck, to me, is the worst of all of them, though, right?
Like, I mean, that one wasn't on the referees. That's on the rule book. Like, they enforced the rule correctly. It's just a bizarre rule.
There was an OPI on Daryl Jackson that nullified a touchdown.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a Wikipedia page about this.
There's a Ben Roethlisberger didn't score, right? Like, he was short of, it was just his helmet, right? Similar to the Vinny Testaverde thing. What is the Wikipedia page?
I'm not seeing that one. There's the OPI and Daryl Jackson. There's the Sean Locklear hold, and then the illegal block by Matt Hass after that. There's an incomplete pass call early in the game from Hasselbeck to Jeremy Stevens. Stevens appeared to have possession and then fumble, only for the officials to roll. He never had complete, which that one's gone from my mind. Apparently the Steelers were upset about some sort of play. Let me just ask you here, though. Were the refs cheating against the Seahawks in this game? Like, If there were any game, and I know you're not going to say yes to this, but
of course not.
If there was any game that the NFL would have wanted a certain team to have won, it was the Steelers in this game in Detroit, Jerome Bettis' homecoming game, or whatever.
How does that help the NFL? Like, they're not going to get higher ratings because the Steelers win the game.
So then what?
The NFL doesn't care. You think the NFL is like, we need to generate a story from the Super Bowl? Literally the most covered sporting event that occurs annually in the world? I think they're good. I mean, I'm a big believer in Hanlon's razor. Never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by incompetence. Especially when you look at who was refereeing this game, because it was like Jeff Triplett, wasn't it?
It was Bill Levy.
Oh, okay. Ah.
Okay, well, I have you here. David Stern, though. Come on.
Would have rigged this?
We can associate some things to malice, right?
Yes.
Anyway.
I mean, there was a lot of incompetence involved in that one, too. Long story short.
I'm actually still not over it.
I'm over it, I gotta say. So the crazy thing is, you know, that's obviously the number one sports story of 2005. There are, I think, two stories that in many years would be the number one sports story of the year in Seattle sports. So next up, UW men's basketball earned the number one overall, a number one seed in the NCAA tournament. Not the number one overall.
Dear God, no. They were like the 14th started the season. Team.
We talked last week about their run to the NCAA tournament. Strong finish in Pac-10 play. They started the season ranked number 22. Some pretty high expectations because they brought basically everyone back. As we mentioned, Curtis Allen was the only senior on that 2003-04 team. Won the Great Alaska Shootout back when that was still a thing. They beat Utah with Andrew Bogut, Oklahoma, and number 19 Alabama.
That was when they got the number one seed.
To the new surgery.
And I remember Thanksgiving weekend going back. I remember sitting in my room at Jan's house on the floor watching all three of those games night after night after night, and the Huskies just winning. And you're like, we didn't really think that much of it, but in hindsight, looking back on it, that is how they won. That and then the road win against NC State. Julius Hodges, NC State.
That was a home win.
Oh, that was the home one. So the previous year was at NC State?
Correct, which they lost.
But beating Julius Hodges, NC State, that was how they did it. Like, this was not a team that, in the end, was one of the four best teams in the country, but they had these very close sort of marquee victories all at once. I think there must have been some sort of interest in the pollsters of having a West Coast team as a number one seed. And it feels like one of those situations where, you know, the second place voting, right? Where you talk about, like, the Huskies were nobody's first choice, but they were everybody's second choice. And that meant that they got to the number one seed.
Yeah, Julius Hodges was very good that year. He once played for the Sonics during summer.
I expected him to be a very good NBA player.
Me too. I think that was Kevin Durant's rookie season that Julius Hodges was on the summer league team. Beat it number 12, NC State, 68-64. Their only non-conference loss was at Gonzaga, and then they went 14-4 in Pac-10 play, second to Arizona. Got two narrow wins over Arizona State and Stanford to reach the Pac-10 tournament final, where they beat the Wildcats 81-72. I think that was a bigger factor in them getting the number one seed, the recency of them winning the Pac-10 tournament.
Still, finishing second in the regular season in the Pac-10 meant they got the number one seed and number one seed.
Well, it was a slightly different Pac-10 back then.
Times have changed. Now, if you're second in the Pac-12, you'll be there are more teams and less tournament spots now.
Entering the Pac-10 tournament, they were ranked 14th in the country. AP
they
poll.
Did still never finish that high in any polls. I think they finished the season ranked number 8 in the polls.
But that makes sense because they lost in the Sweet 16.
So I want to look up the exact date. Wait, I had this up.
that they got the number one seed?
February 26, 2005, UW versus Arizona. I was looking at this and I was like, why wasn't I at this game? But this was before I was at UW. No. So this was the spring.
Wait, Arch, you're thinking of that game? It wasn't the Pac-10 tournament game?
No, I think we were together watching the Pac-10 tournament game.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. We played basketball beforehand with our cousin Chris.
So February 26, 2005, I'm at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. And there's like, I'm up there with my girlfriend at the time, and there's like a common area downstairs in her dorm or whatever where there's a TV. And I'm down there just like freaking out the entire game over this UW Arizona game. No one else cares. Like, there's not another soul on that campus who cared about this basketball game. And then, like, I think there was like a jump ball or something at the end of the game. There was some exciting moment that happened that went UW's way, and I pumped my fist in the air so excitedly I threw my arm out of its socket.
Now, was this the first time you did that?
I think I'd done it before, but this was the worst time. Still to this day, the worst time that I've done it.
Even worse than when you did it playing Sonic softball. Or was that Storm softball? Sonic softball?
Yeah, it was not that bad. I mean, that was bad enough that I had to quit playing softball. But so this, my arm went out of its socket. I have bad shoulders. And there I did. I don't know. I'm going to knock on wood when I say that. I haven't really hurt them in a long time. But, like, it's been over a decade since I've hurt my shoulders. But, like, it came out of its socket and stayed out of the socket. I put my fist in the air. I'm in this common space where there are other people around. I'm screaming and writhing on the floor. And nobody has any idea what's going on, right? Because, like, she didn't know. I wasn't, like, my arm's out of the socket. It just hurt, and I'm screaming. I wasn't, like, there's no time to explain what's happening. And then I'm laying there being like, I'm going to have to go to the fucking hospital in Bellingham or whatever. I'm like, none of this is what I want. And then eventually it slides back into the socket, right? I'm in horrible pain for quite a long time. That night, I'm laying in her bed, or asleep in her bed, and I've had night terrors two times in my entire life, or something like that, or whatever. Vivid dreams that have made me do insane things. And I dreamt that...
One of which was when we were living together, and then you freaked out the cat.
No, there was like a feral cat or a cat in heat outside that woke me up, and I thought it was attacking me.
You definitely freaked out the cat.
Oh, and I definitely terrified the cat. I remember... Okay, all right, both stories. Here we go. So that time, my bedroom and Jan's house is upstairs. Yours is downstairs, right below me. There was like, I had my window open because it was summer and it was hot, and I, like, for whatever reason, freaked out because there was a cat that woke me up or whatever, and I ran out screaming at the top of my lungs, like, ah! Broke my toe on the door. Our cat kitten started just going insane, and I remember, like, calming down and, like, coming to and walking into your room, and you're standing there with the covers half over, or sitting there with the covers half over your face, like, just,
I mean, I was scared of the cat.
It's like,
and then I remember watching the movie. What's the movie about? War Games.
Yeah, I remember you watched that.
The only way to win is not
and
to
play. I got back into bed because I didn't know my toe was broken at the time. And then I got back into bed and I was like, wow, that hurts really bad. And then I couldn't walk for like a week after that.
Good times.
So, second time, I thought that my girlfriend was a killer or whatever trying to attack me in the bed. My arm had already hurt. I don't know if those two things are correlated, but there's something going on. So I freak out. She's on the top of a bunk bed. I jump out of the bunk bed, run down the dorm hall, again screaming as loud as I can. I, like, come to at the end of the hall and then have to walk back, and I, like, see her poking out, so I know which room it is, fortunately. And I'm like, I, like, run back into the room. And then so we're laying there, and I'm like, oh, my God, what the fuck? And then for the next, like, 5 minutes, you could hear a bunch of doors opening and closing down the hall. Oh, my God. That was also the first ever time that I watched Clone High that day.
Clone, technically a 2004 show, right? Clone High?
Yeah. Or earlier, but freaking legendary. Because, you know, colleges used to have – I don't know if this is still – this is definitely not still the case. Colleges used to have these, like, shared servers where people would share music. And so, like, people who went to real colleges, not unfortunately Highland Community College, would have these like massive databases of music available and TV or whatever you look through. I stole so much music from there in 2005.
I never did. So the Huskies, like we mentioned, we were expecting them probably to be a number two seed, I think, after they won the Pac-10 tournament.
Or three. I mean, it seemed reasonable that they could have been a two or a three. We were feeling good.
And then they flash up that last number one, and they're the Huskies.
And we were both. This is another situation where we were both watching at the same house, but not on the same TV.
Correct. I think I was working on some Sonic stuff, because they played that day, too.
And I was watching upstairs, see the Huskies jump, come up, and then just start screaming and run downstairs where you are. And then we celebrate being a number one seed for the first time in UW history. And last time, sorry. The first and last time in UW history.
And then it becomes a moment of terror, because it's like, oh no, we're going to be the first number one to ever lose to a 16.
Oh yeah, it was going down.
But it was a tight game, but they did beat Montana with Larry Kostrobiak as head coach, 88-77, and then crushed number 22 Pacific, 97-79, in the second round, reaching the Sweet 16 where they faced a Rick Pitino Louisville team that was way better in every single way.
This to me is, this is even almost as damning as the refereeing in Super Bowl XL, that Louisville, I don't know how the pollsters, like, got together and decided that Louisville was a number four seed when at the time they were 33-4 or something. Like, this was just because they were judging Conference USA so harshly. This was a team that was definitely better than UW. I think if I recall correctly, which I obviously don't because it was 15 years ago, in Kenpom.com, which I think we maybe recently discovered, Louisville was in the top four and the Huskies were whatever, like 12 or something. And looking at it being like, they're obviously losing this game to Louisville.
I mean, the thing is, like, Louisville was better than most of the two or three seeds, but if the Huskies were where they were supposed to be, they probably would have played a team about as good as Louisville. So I don't know if we actually can complain about it that much in hindsight.
This team was really – this was a Final Four caliber team.
Well, they made the Final
That's
Four.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, before they lost to Illinois, who at that point had only one loss all season.
If you lose one seed, it doesn't matter. But if you lose in the Sweet 16, it is a bad showing.
A Francisco Garcia.
God, Francisco Garcia. I remember thinking he was going to be good in the NBA, too.
I mean, he had a good run for a while there.
So there was...
And that game was not particularly close.
And I remember having hope throughout it, but it was just like, they're just better than we are. There was a really hard screen that they didn't call foul on, right?
Yes. Yes, that is... That
dude who wore goggles.
Juan Palacios.
And he wore goggles, right? Yes. I don't remember who he hit, but it was bullshit. Bobby Jones.
Maybe it's not Juan Palacios. He doesn't appear. Maybe it was the other guy, Ellis Miles.
Maybe. I don't know. This is not going to be on YouTube. Unless there's a still upset 15 years later UW YouTube.
Otis George? I'm going through the
George
here. I'm not seeing anyone. Otis
I
George?
I think it was no, Otis George.
Doesn't appear to wear goggles, but I mean, what are those guys said a really hard
and
screen?
They didn't call a foul. It was nothing. It's fucking bullshit.
I don't know that was going to change the outcome of the game. I mean, they were just a better team, and nobody for the Huskies played particularly well. Nate Robinson
Otis,
was one
here,
of seven
here we go.
For the field
from
the
our
game.
Good friends at Seattle Times. Wait, sorry, from the Seattle Times.
No, they're doing great coverage of the novel coronavirus outbreak. They are our good friends now.
It's like I can see the preview of the link, but when I click on it, it just takes me to SeattleTimes.com. So here we go.
Because the story no longer exists.
Sports UW ending just didn't fit. Seattle Times newspaper, originally published Friday, March 25th, 2005 at 12 a.m. Otis George set a screen on Bobby Jones at midcourt that it would have made Baltimore .. <There's>, it would have made Baltimore something. And then ellipses, and after 4 delicious months of some of the best college basketball Seattle has ever seen, more ellipses. So.
It was still a great season. Like, I mean, we hadn't seen a Sweet 16 team. I guess it was only 7 years, but, you know, a Sweet 16 caliber team in a long time.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the greatest heights that Lorenzo Romo ever achieved. I still think the team the next year was almost even better.
I still feel like this would be an interesting thing to go through at some point. Which was Lorenzo Romar's best team? I feel like it was the 2011 team, even though that team did not, or the 2010 team, I guess.
The one where they played, where they lost to Purdue?
No, the 2011 team. Even though they lost in the second round, I think it was the best of these teams.
That was the team that they lost in the second
round. Had Isaiah Thomas, Justin Holliday, CJ Wilcox.
Oh, or they lost to North Carolina?
Freshman Terrence Ross won the Pac-10 tournament with the cold-blooded shot.
I don't know about that.
But they just lost so many close games earlier in the year that they were like a 7 seed or whatever.
On YouTube, when you search Otis George Green, number one, Transformational Prayer by the Global Prayer Resource Network. Number two, Garfield, 2 out of 5 movie clip, Odie Saves Garfield. Number three, Al Green, How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? WMV. I don't. Sadly, I think this one is lost to time.
Wow. Well, let's get to our third big Seattle sports story of 2005, and that's the Sonics winning the Northwest Division in their first and only playoff series since 1998. We talked last week about the hot start that the Sonics got off to in 2004-05. A bit of a spring swoon, dealt with some injuries, which briefly made Damian Wilkins a key starter as an undrafted rookie on this team.
We like Damian Wilkins.
We did. But still finished 52-30, winning the Northwest Division with the fourth best record in the Western Conference and earning the number 3 seed. They faced the Sacramento Kings in the first round. A Kings team that had traded Chris Webber earlier in the year.
To who? For what?
Philadelphia.
Wow, I do not remember Chris Webber ever playing for Philadelphia. I guess that you say that, I can kind of picture it.
A huge game 4 from Ray Allen, who went for 45 points on 17 of 28 shooting in that series, as the Sonics took a 3-1 lead, closed it out at home in game 5. Jerome James, playing against his former team, averaged 17.2 points, 9.4 rebounds, and 2.2 blocks in the series.
And got himself paid in that series.
He sure did, and walked around with a trash bag afterwards because he said that that's what the Kings gave him to clean out his locker room after they waived him. But that was the deal that got him the big deal from the Knicks that summer as a free agent. Sonics advanced to play San Antonio, the eventual NBA champions. Ray and Vlade Radmanovic both suffered sprained ankles in Game 1. Radmanovic did not return in that series, followed in Game 3 by a Rashard Lewis toe sprain that sidelined him the last 3 games of that series. Tim Duncan missed a possible game winner with 0.9 seconds left in Game 3 as the home team took the first 5 games of the series, leaving it back at Key Arena for a must-win Game 6 for the Sonics, where Duncan made the go-ahead shot off of Manu Ginobili feed in the closing seconds, and Ray Allen was unable to connect on a 3-pointer from the corner that would have won the game.
You know what? You want to know what I remember there was a foul, I think Potapenko foul, which this is the discrepancy between these two teams.
Vitaly Potapenko was defending Tim Duncan on all of those plays.
There was a, good God. I can tell you that at the time I could not appreciate Tim Duncan. Maybe now I would appreciate Tim Duncan a little bit more. But I definitely at the time could appreciate that Vitaly Potapenko could not defend Tim Duncan. And seeing that happen and him score, it's just like, after the entire season that we went through and how fun that season was, having it end with Vitaly Potapenko trying to defend Tim Duncan and doing so unsuccessfully.
I mean, it wasn't his fault. It was actually because Manu had a blow-by. I mean, it really wasn't anything. Potapenko had to come over. But there's only 5/10 of a second left on the clock after that.
That 3 that Ray took, it was right in front of us. And I swear to God, it was like, it was going in.
Oh, it was online. Yeah, we all thought it was going in.
I mean, they were losing the next game anyway. It doesn't matter, you know? Right. So that's it. But, you know, you get into, so you're saying there's a chance territory, basically. But like that one, that 3 that Ray took, it still haunts me. like watching that shot go up and being like, you know, one of those moments where you just know when, if it goes in, you're just going to freak out, right? Like, you're going to go insane. You're around all, like, these, whatever, 13,000 people or something, that they're all going to just go nuts. And you just see, you can picture it happening. And that three doesn't go in. And really, that is the last exciting moment in Sonic's history.
No, they won the lottery. Or got number two in the lottery.
Clay Ben won the fucking lottery. I don't even care. I did not care by that point.
I definitely care.
I mean, it was fun or whatever, but, like, you know, like, we knew the writing was on the wall at that point, and winning the lottery was... how about this? It was the last exciting on-court moment in Sonic's history.
I mean, I could probably come up with some, but yes. I mean, that was one of my favorite all-time teams to cover. Like, one of my memories from that season is just spending every pregame in the locker room. Ray Allen sat at his locker the entire media availability every game. Rashard Lewis was next to him because Rashard copied like everything Ray Allen did. Antonio Daniels was in there a lot of the time.
Including for an East competitor. No.
Well, he did that ahead of Ray, actually. He did not copy Ray Allen.
Ray Allen he had no choice.
Nick Collison, and there was always just these great, lively conversations with everyone. It was such a like fun group, such an unexpected season, and I will always remember.
Yeah. I mean, it was the most fun NBA season that we ever paid attention to.
In my time covering the team, yeah. UNM football, as we mentioned last week, hired Tyrone Willingham as a replacement with Keith Gilbertson, and I was pretty excited about this. Like,
oh, we love
Willingham. Had done a good job at Stanford. You know, we attributed the lack of success at Notre Dame to Notre Dame, which actually was correct. I got to admit, I had forgotten how bad his first season was. The Huskies went 2-9 that year with wins over Idaho and at Arizona, but did show signs of promise late. A competitive loss at Oregon State, the blowout win at the Wildcats by 24 points, and then a narrow 26-22 loss to Wazoo in the Apple Cup. Isaiah Stanbeck took over as quarterback and wasn't bad. Completed just 54% of his passes, but for 8.1 yards per attempt. Husky opponents completed 67% of their passes. Nobody else in the Pac-10 allowed more than 61% completion.
Wasn't that Oregon State game that horrible game that we had at home?
No.
Where it poured rain? Was that 2006?
Well, 2006. Nah.
Yeah, no, 2006 was the year that. That Oregon State game was at home.
No, because 2006 was the year they played Oregon State at home. That's when
November 5th, 3:30 p.m. Oregon State Husky Stadium lost 10-18.
But that's not the game.
That was the horrible game. It was at home in 2005. What fucking year are you talking about?
No, I guess it was. Yeah.
It was. I was going to say, I remember where I was living when this happened. That was the worst day of my entire life. I definitely remember giving you a ride to this game. I think I would remember it, except for the next year when we inexplicably decided to drive to Eugene, Oregon to go see UW against Oregon. And let me just tell you, that was not a fun drive back.
It was
so this year
I wasn't there, but I know.
I was very excited because I'd started at UW this fall, and I'd gotten the season tickets for like $100 or something. And I think this was the time where you would buy football tickets to get access to basketball tickets. Was the way that it went, because all of a sudden people wanted basketball tickets more because the Husky football team was going 2-9. But like, before I'd even taken a class at UW, I'd seen first-round draft pick Brady Quinn start against them, hitting up first starting pitcher Jeff Samardzija, right? Like,
yeah.
And then also had seen, well, so okay, USC was later on, but that game against USC was like watching that. I mean, that was the year that USC played Texas. In that,
you had seen a young man before you started class. You had seen a young man named Marshawn Lynch.
Yeah, that's play true. At Husky Stadium. I have no recollection of that Cal game.
I mean, he was a backup at that point, I think.
Who was Cal's starter? That was Kyle Bowler's Cal team?
No, this is the quarterback is someone named Joe Ayoub, who I have never heard of. But oh no, I guess Lynch was the starter, but he split time with Justin
that
Forsett.
That was seen the most thrilling running back tandem in the Pac-10 history. And then
two future Seahawks
later
legends.
That year, like honestly, like being able to be at Husky Stadium and watch future Hall of Famer Matt Leinart. But like that USC team, it was exciting to get beat by USC in that time.
I mean, that's the greatest college football team. That I mean, we talked about the Miami
I don't
team,
know,
but
man, that USC team lost, and Miami team didn't lose.
Oh, but that just that whole like the Bush Lindale White backfield.
No, they were incredible. Like seeing all those players, and there was a punt return that Reggie Bush had for a touchdown, where he ran into a skirmish of players. And just out, and I hadn't been to that many football games at the time, so I didn't, you know, I was a less experienced, like, viewer of football live. And he ran into just like a pile of bodies, and then out the other side came Reggie Bush, and the pile of bodies was still there, but Reggie Bush was running for a touchdown on the other side. It was like, it was one of the most exciting football plays I've ever seen live. Seeing Reggie Bush in college was unlike anything else. Like, I remember going into that draft, which I guess would have been in 2006, the idea that they wouldn't draft, which – and we had no idea about the value of running backs at the time. But Mario Williams was drafted number one overall, and the idea that you wouldn't draft Reggie Bush with the first overall pick was fucking insane. I was like, this is the most thrilling athlete that I've ever seen live in my entire life. Like, how do you not take Reggie Bush? If you would have told us in that moment that Reggie Bush would have had like an average NFL career, maybe even a below average NFL career, like there's no way I was believing that.
Yep. All checks out.
So it was fun no matter what is what I'm saying. Like,
oh yeah.
It was, and this was more like on a like firsthand experience type situation because I was just having fun by going to these games, except for that Oregon State game where it rained more than it's ever rained any day in Seattle history, I think. We were just, like, our shirts were soaked through, and I think we had you come pick us up in, like, the third quarter.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, the Texans were in, like, their fourth season, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, I think they're in their first year.
I was going to look at the draft. You know, it was not fun. The Mariners spent big on free agency, paying $64 million over 5 years for Adrian Beltre, who turned out to be a great player, Hall of Famer, but terrible for what was then Safeco Field, and $50 million over 4 years for Richie Sexson. Then they lost 93 games again. LOL. But
Ichiro had a bunch
was a bright
stable.
Spot. Felix Hernandez made his debut in August and posted a 2.67 ERA and 84 and a third innings. And I spent some time trying to track down which was the Felix game we went to during his rookie season. Most likely either August 9th versus Minnesota, which is first home start, or August 15th versus Kansas City.
I'm going to guess that it was August 15th versus Kansas City, but
it seems more likely that we would not have gone to his first home start.
I mean, Felix was important enough at the time. This was baseball, which, by the way, this was the peak of USS Mariner, right?
Yes.
Which we haven't talked about at all. But USS Mariner, as far as...
Oh, so formative.
Baseball fan sites was a huge deal. That was...
I mean, that's the only reason I know about Felix, is because I had been reading about him on USS Mariner. He's King Felix for years. I don't know if he was King Felix.
Dave Cameron and...
Derek Zumstag.
I was like, Jeff Zumstag? Derek Zumstag's USS Mariner, which...
There was one other writer, right?
Back I'm sure the there was. but which at the time was essential reading for Mariners fans.
Oh, yeah. Dave Cameron, SeaTac's Fire.
Really?
Jason Barker was
Did
the
he go to Tahiti High School?
Of USS
Home Mariner. Of?
No, he went to like Seattle Christian, I think, or some tiny Christian
right.
school.
Well, I was going to say that he was dead to me, but if he would have gone to Highline or Mount Rainier, then he would have been, but I'll accept it.
Yeah, he was not a rival.
I'll accept
in any
it.
Sense. Let's wrap up Seattle sports with the Storm coming off the championship in 2004 was lost starters Sheree Sam and Kamila Dichkova from that team in free agency, along with key reserve Tully Bevilacqua.
Sheree Sam had the braids. Wow, yes. Man, she was awesome in that championship team.
Not really.
She was thrilling. We liked her a lot.
Yeah. So they had three rookies in the rotation that year, really went heavy with international players. Australian Susie Bakovich, Italian Francesca Zara, Russian Natalia Vodopianova, but still went 20-14 that season and were the number two seed once again in the West. They won game one against the Houston Comets shortly after Hurricane Katrina. There was a bunch of refugees from New Orleans that had been bused to Houston and that attended the game. It was a really odd situation. But then, so they came home with two chances, needing to win one, a situation that only one team in WNBA history had ever lost the series before then, but suffered a narrow 67-64 loss in game two, followed by a lopsided 75-58 loss in game three of that series, with Cheryl Swoops recording, I think, the first playoff triple-double in WNBA history.
Wow.
So that was a really crushing blow, because it seemed like that series was over in the Storm's favor, and then all of a sudden the season was over in two games.
Who do you think, from the 2006 NFL draft, of Reggie Bush or Mario Williams had the most Pro Football Reference career added value? Approximate value, sorry.
I think it's Mario Williams. But
it is still Mario Williams. It's okay. Not by much. Really, I have to say, the beginning of this draft, Reggie Bush in the end got to quite a high approximately. And he was number two until you get to pick 11, Jay Cutler. So,
I mean, he had some good years there, Reggie Bush.
I mean, Matt Leinart, I think up there with the worst in the first round, only Ty Hill was lower. John McCargo. Who I think might have died for the Bills, the Seahawks that year drafted Kelly Jennings.
John McCargo is still happily living.
What happened? Did he retire really early? What happened to John McCargo? Was he just a bust?
I mean, he just was not a good player.
None of us are happily living.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
There are two.
He's happy as compared to you thinking he's dead.
There were three Pro Bowlers in that first round, right? Bold means you're a Pro Bowler. Man, this is a brutal draft. People thought that NBA draft was bad. Mercedes Lewis.
Devin Hester at 57.
Mercedes Lewis, Jonathan Joseph, and Vernon Davis were the Pro Bowlers. Yes, like, seriously, if you would have told me after watching that USC versus Texas game that neither Vince Young nor Reggie Bush would ever make a Pro Bowl. Like, it is true. Unheard of. And that Andrew Whitworth would still be in the damn NFL.
Wait, Vince Young. No, I think you're looking at the wrong thing. According to Wikipedia, Vince Young was a Pro Bowler.
Really?
As was Mario Williams, DeBrickashaw Ferguson, Vernon Davis, what Dante Whitner, Jay Cutler. I don't know.
All right, well, I take back.
Maybe that's traded picks or something.
Hmm.
But Reggie Bush was not. Nor was AJ Hawk. It was the number five pick. All right, should we talk about music?
Let's try. We can try to get through music faster in 2005.
I thought a good place to start was the two albums that were released on August 30th, Plans by Death Cab for Cutie and Late Registration by Kanye.
Oh, well, I'll let you start with Plans because I did not hear it until 2015.
I mean, I don't know that I heard the album in its entirety that much earlier than that, but I don't conceive of it as an album, but several notable songs on there: Soul Meets Body, I Will Follow You Into the Dark, Someday You Will Be Loved, so much moderate indie rock.
It was the first Death Cab record that was released on a major label, and it was like this was the, you know, the OC had happened, right? Like, I think in 2005, I remember meeting a girl at UW and watching Garden State with her. Like, that was what 2005 was. We watched Garden State together. We listened to the Shins. Like, the indie rock had gone mainstream by 2005.
Yes, it had.
And then Late Registration by Kanye, which to this day of my pre-Trump Kanye records, which... This is my least favorite. I anticipated late registration. I had talked last week about how much I loved College Dropout and cared so much about College Dropout and had the most anticipation for late registration. He had Diamonds from Sierra Leone as the first single, which we were, our minds were blown by, right? And then there was Gold Digger, which was pretty huge, right? With Jamie Foxx as Otis Redding on Gold Digger. And it was like, singles were incredible. He worked with John Bryan for this record. And we just thought it was going to be like massive. And it just like, for whatever reason, these songs, except for Gone featuring Cameron, never connected with me. It was like, I like it. It's still a Kanye record, but there's so many songs on here. I'm just like, whatever. Like,
My description to you on G-Chat the other day was there's so much filler on this album.
He got Kanye tightened up by the next record, by Graduation, right? Like, yeah. Graduation was, wow, still his most played song is Stronger. I'm kind of shocked by that. 666 million plays. Really makes you think, doesn't it? But like, I don't, late registration, I feel like Kanye was trying to do, and he had the hits or whatever, but like a little bit too much. There were a little bit too many skits. There were a little bit.
Well,
there was maybe a lot. It's also their number two, where you're just like, dude, like, it was this is the Kanye record. And I know a lot of people really love late registration, but it was just never for me in the same sort of way.
To me, I felt like there was a comparison between the Franz Ferdinand follow-up record that year, and that was checking notes here. You Could Have It So Much Better, and Late Registration, where both of them have like a strong song or two, but in general, not a comparison to their debuts the previous year.
I would agree with that critically. Late Registration took Kanye up a notch. Like,
I don't think that's aged well.
No, I don't think so either.
Some debuts in 2005. Rihanna with Music of the Sun, an album that I listened to and don't know any of the songs except Ponda Replay, and none of them are very good. And like, she hadn't figured it out, or they hadn't figured out how to use Rihanna, yes, or to like just let her turn her, yes, loose. They were trying to make her into like some island sound, and that didn't work right. Wolf Parade comes on the scene. Our friends Wolf Parade with Apologies to the Queen Mary. Not quite my favorite Wolf Parade album. That's, God, of course, Expo 86, but still some bangers on this one. And then LCD Sound System with their self-titled debut.
It is kind of amazing that you mentioned that third. Shine a Light by Wolf Parade. I had a burn CD and it froze. I think I stole from the Western like music exchange thing. It froze for like a half second in the middle of that. And so it's just like that propulsive like doo 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 doo, and then it pauses and then it comes back, and I was like, wow, they should have done that in the real song. Wolf Parade was like the most exciting thing in indie rock in 2005. LCD Sound System. So there was, did I talk about this before? 120 minutes.
I'm not sure.
Sorry, not 120 minutes. Oh God. The MTV show after 120 minutes.
I don't know what you're talking about, so I can't help you there.
Subterranean. there was Daft Punk is playing at my house, which is like insane for us in 2005. Like, it was a generation of kids who were getting into indie rock that had not listened to electronic music at all. Maybe this is just me, but like, I feel like a lot of people were just like, oh, when we heard that first LCD Sound System. And I feel like LCD Sound System, more than probably any music, even stuff that I cared more about or was more popular in 2005, and they got better after 2005. You know, like, the best LCD Sound System albums did not happen in 2005, but, like, this was predicting the next 10 years of music right here. And it was, like, James Murphy. It didn't even feel at the time like it was that vital. It was like, oh, that's that, like, cool kind of weird song. And then by the time you get to Sound of Silver or whatever, you're like, oh, this person's a visionary. But like it all started right here. And I remember listening to that. I got it on CD from the library and listening to it and being like, what the fuck is this? You know? The best song on that album is Losing My Edge, though, where he's talking about like all these like classic underground like records or whatever, and he's talking about he's losing his edge, and he's like, I've heard that you have, and then whatever, all these like classic sort of obscure sort of legendary like underground music, and it's just like, this is the perfect fucking music for 2005, right, where everybody is like, the hipster mentality was that first LCD Sound System album.
Yes.
And that's when, you know, like, that's when hipsterdom really came to be a thing.
When was hipster runoff?
I think it was a little bit later. This is before Chillwave happens. We're in the pre-Chillwave era. So also 2005, I'm painting our house on Queen Anne, 408 Aloha Street, right before I'm about to start at UW. And I think it was like the week before Bumbershoot or something. And Jan is making me paint. So I'm like, okay, I will paint this house if you give me money to go to Easy Street and buy CDs after. And one of those CDs that I buy, the original version with Superman on the cover, and that is Come On Feel the Illinois by Sufjan.
Officially just Illinois, but yes, styled on the album Come On Feel the Illinois. And what a good album.
It changed everything for Sufjan. It was like a KXP album that people were really excited about. But like, I remember getting it and like looking at the CD and listening through it. And it's one of those things where I feel like it was so long and so dense, very pop, but very dense, where like it took you time and like you'd be a year into listening to it or something. And maybe there were smarter people than me who heard it right away or whatever, but you're like, oh, fuck, Casimir Pulaski Day. You're like, holy shit. Like, where did that come from? And I think it's...
I mean, I like that one from the start, I think.
But it was one of those things where, like, you know, at the beginning, you're like, Stephen A. Douglas was a great debater, right? But Abraham Lincoln was the great emancipator. That was, like, the line in 2005. And then the other stuff, like Predatory Wasps and Casimir Pulaski Day, sort of moved to the forefront as, like, these are real songs, right? This isn't, like, a dope Stephen A. Douglas reference.
Let's not be demeaning to Stephen A. Douglas references.
No. That's great also. But it feels like at some point those songs moved beyond the gimmick, right? And that was, like... Like, yeah, the song's called Casimir Pulaski Day, which is a thing in Illinois and isn't other places, but, like, it's a great song no matter what it's called, and it has nothing to do with Casimir Pulaski Day. And so, like, the reference was, I think it was really important at the time when we didn't, I don't think the masses really recognized how important of an artist Sufjan was in 2005, and as time kept passing, it was like, oh, this is, like, one of the most important voices in alternative music. Some other ones that I wanted to mention, which we can get through music relatively quickly for this year, because I've got one more thing, but super quick. I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning by Bright Eyes, released on the same day as Digital Ash and Digital Urn by Bright Eyes. To me, I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning, not an album that I cared about until 2015, 16. I was watching, oh God, what is dude's name? What's that show, Crashing? You know what I'm talking about?
It's a show, yeah.
Oh, God. Is it Crashing? Pete Holmes. Pete Holmes' show, Crashing. So it would have been at least 2017. So this is recent, where, like, Ode to Joy comes on at the end of one of those episodes, and I'm just like... what is this? You know, I was like, this song sounds familiar, but I don't know if I've ever heard it before. And from that point forward, now in the year 2020, I have listened to I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning probably more than any album in full this year.
Wow.
It's like the music is just, I mean, he's talking about the fucking Iraq War. You're like, okay, yes. And there's some stuff like themes about Christianity, which just aren't as present anymore in our modern society. And I'm not like, but Conor Oberst as a songwriter, as one of, again, similar to Sufjan, like the most important voices in alternative music, Conor Oberst has never been better. And it's music that just keeps feeling important. Right? Like I would tell you, go listen to I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning tomorrow. And it's going to fucking hit. Like it is the perfect album. Give Me Fiction by Spoon. First time that I ever cared about Spoon. But I turned my camera on. I was driving in Boulevard Park and I heard I turned my camera on and I was like, all right, well, this is what I'm going to be listening to every single day for the next 5 years. The Sunset Tree by Mountain Goats, which like a turn to more accessible music for Mountain Goats, but listening to dance music for the first time ever, I was like, oh man, John Darnielle. Me and my girlfriend at the time used to fight about the Mountain Goats because she was like, I don't like hearing this dude's voice. He sounds like a mountain goat, and I'm like, you're not getting it.
I don't know if I like his voice, but I still like the music.
You know, it doesn't fucking matter. What John Darnielle is speaking to your soul. It doesn't matter what his voice sounds like. And then also, Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, self-titled record. I had never really listened to, didn't really care about, but this was the moment in 2007 where Pitchfork was this wasn't Hipster Runoff, this was Pitchfork's moment. And that was like a mostly unknown record that they gave Best New Music out of nowhere, and the band blew up or whatever. Like Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah was the only band that people cared about for like 2 weeks in indie rock because of this Pitchfork review, which years later led to a sketch from, I think this was a pre-Human Giant sketch, but Aziz Ansari's Human Giant. Do you remember members of Human Giant?
Yeah.
Who are they?
Rob Hubel.
Oh yeah, Hubel. Huge Hubel moment.
And then
Paul Scheer,
like, yeah, who was on the Low Post last week.
Really?
Talking about Human Giant extensively.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Damn. It's a lot of fun.
Zach Lowe's? Because to me, Human Giant has been lost to time.
That was the first time I've thought about it. I thought about it actually previously because I was like, what year was that? We're going to need to remember Human Giant. And then Zach bringing it up was the second time I had thought about it.
Wow, Zach Lowe really brought it up. That's kind of wild. So
yeah.
There was a sketch on it was like their internet show pre-Human Giant that they had, where Clell Tickle, indie rock publicist or whatever, and it's about the story of...
Oh, he's trying to get it on Pitchfork?
Yeah, as Clell Tickle, trying to get Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, this review on Pitchfork, and Rob Hubel is like the enforcer or whatever. That is like my old, that is the lasting impression of Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. So that, wow. That was okay. So Bumbershoot, 2005. Are we ready to?
Wait, I thought we gotta mention the White Stripes album.
Do we?
Yeah, there's at least two quality songs off of that.
Okay.
I mean, I would say that. Blue Orchid and My Doorbell are strong songs after that. Also, 50 Cent's follow-up.
Yeah,
we have to mention.
It was a big deal, and for the next Kanye album, it was the competition between Kanye and 50 Cent about who would sell more.
Hate It or Love It, just a little bit. Like, that's still
Hate It or Love It is not on the 50 Cent album. That is on the Game album, the documentary.
Well, it's also on The Massacre. I hate to break it to you.
Am I wrong about this? They just threw it on everything at the time?
I guess so.
Yeah. Let me just pull up Wikipedia here. Single by The Game featuring 50 Cent from the album The Documentary by The Game. So they just put it on there because it was 2005 and who cares? But no, this was the year that The Game first came into existence. Former Wazoo basketball player Jason Taylor.
Okay, Bumbershoot 2005. Well,
wait, well, there was one more thing that I want to mention. Okay, so also 2005. I feel like this happened in 2006, but we need to bring it up. I think 2005 was the first year that I remember there being a song in the summer.
Oh, really?
And that was Feel Good Inc. by Gorillaz.
Yeah.
It's like if you went to Wild Waves with Jan, Feel Good Inc. was playing. You'd be there for an hour, and it played six times. There was nothing else. It was like it reached the perfect point of being kind of non-threatening, but a little bit dancey and a little bit hip-hop. And also, it was by white people. Enough white people that Wild Waves could get behind it and like the mainstream could get behind it for 2005. Like that was ubiquitous that summer.
I have a very specific memory. It's different from your like being injured memory, but like I think caffeine may have made my heart race a little bit around this point. And that combined with a panic attack made me think that I was having a heart attack and staying up one entire night and just watching MTV or VH1 or something. VH1 wasn't playing music videos at this point. Something that was playing music videos all night long. And that definitely came on like three or four times during
the
period.
I did the same thing when I was listening to Park Life in 98. I was snorting Smarties.
And then I stopped drinking pop and now I'm fine. So there you go.
You're missing out. Okay. Bumbershoot 2005. I'm waiting in line to see Elvis Costello. It's pouring rain, right? We're talking Oregon State levels of rain to see Elvis Costello. And meanwhile, unbeknownst to me, across the country, the most important music in 2005 happens. Do you want to know what that moment is?
What's that?
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Is
2005. Kanye West on the Katrina telethon, right next to a stunned Mike Myers, delivers that message, and that was the moment that Kanye became Kanye, right? Like this was when Kanye became brash and outspoken, would say whatever. And again, we're talking like saying about Reggie Bush, the idea that Kanye in 2020 would be one of Trump's biggest celebrity supporters. Is just, it was unheard of in 2005. It was like Kanye was all of us in 2005. And it's hard to sort of reckon with as somebody who is like, hell yeah, Kanye, like you're speaking truth to power. And then now how everything has changed. So that really otherwise, when I look back at the lineup of Bumbershoot in 2005, I mean, I remember going to a lot of these things. It was the first time. That I'd ever seen, like, The Far Side with Talib Kweli opening. And I remember, like, I had nothing about The Far Side. But after that, I was like, okay, She Keeps on Passing Me By, sure. Seeing The Decemberists, who also, I think, had a huge 2005. Maybe 2004?
2005 was 16 Military Wives, and I think that was their biggest breakthrough, as I recall it, at least.
I think you're wrong about that. Hold on.
It appears this Clil Tickle indie marketing.
Oh, Pigrass did come out in 2005.
Video is no longer
on
the internet.
Are you kidding me?
It's very disappointing.
Yeah. So Pigrass comes out in 2005. 16 Military Wives, which is like when people were roasting Bush in 2005. Oh, man. There was that. There was the Mariner's Revenge song, which to this day, huge part of their set. But seeing the Decembers was huge also at the time, which I always felt weird about because I was like, not weird about, but I always felt like I was on really early. Went to a comedy show that I'm pretty sure Eugene Merman was part of, which was years before he became a popular comedian. And then Aziz Ansari. Saw Aziz Ansari for the first time ever in 2005, and he was indie. Right, like he would tell jokes about Kanye songs, and that was at Bumbershoot. Which, granted, he's playing fucking Bumbershoot. Like, I can accept that he was not a small comedian at the time, but like it felt like to us who were there, like we were on something really early. We were like, this dude is going to be huge. And then by the time he became huge, we resented the whole thing, of course. But him telling a joke, we did. You didn't. We did. Aziz Ansari, there's a line on College Dropout where Kanye's like trying to make it 5 beats a day for 3 summers. And Aziz Ansari is like, yeah, that's not hard. Boom, boom, boom. Okay. Bam, 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 bam. Okay. Like, him telling that joke, and I was like, Aziz Ansari speaks to me. It's like, he's one of us. And it feels like at some point, like, he was the coolest comedian on the planet in 2005.
Yeah.
I really like the rest of the rest is like Trey Anastasio. I didn't go to that. I remember going to see Common, but I don't really have memories of it. Definitely did not go see Garbage.
I gotta say, revisiting the music of 2005, B from Common, like Forgotten, was outstanding.
I mean, we talked about it last week with the track being recorded on Chappelle's show. Is on B. But I do want to say 2005 was the first year that I was ever aware of Sasquatch Music Festival. And I'm pretty sure Kanye played in 2005. I'm going to see it. I'm going to see if this is correct. Because I know that Kanye played at some point. 2005. Maybe we should start looking at this because it's a hell of a lot better than Bumbershoot was in 2005. Sasquatch 2005. Arcade Fire. Block Party, Blue Scholars, Modest Mouse, Joanna Newsom, Pixies, Kanye West, Wilco. Like,
there you go.
It's pretty undefeated. And I remember hearing about it in like radio ads on KXP, and they're like, Sasquatch Music Festival at the Gorge. And I'm like, just the idea of getting to the Gorge for a one-day music festival, a one-day indie rock music festival, it just seemed hard. I was like, I'm going to tell Jan that I'm driving to the Gorge and then I drive back or whatever. Like, it seemed so complicated. We should look at both of these as we go forward quickly. But, like, that lineup, I mean, it was the Pixies the year after they played Bumbershoot. But, like,
I'm sorry, what about this has been quick?
When we talk about it, just quick. We haven't talked about Bumbershoot for a long time. And I remember them having Kanye, which, can you imagine, is Kanye? I guess Blue Scholars were on there, but, like, there's two hip-hop artists. This was why, as indie people, Kanye seemed like one of ours. Because he was playing Sasquatch in
2005. A big year in television.
Really?
Premieres that year. The Office, the American version, which premiered with 6 episodes in the spring, then had a traditional full second season, and definitely went on to become one of the most influential sitcoms in modern television.
Yes.
I went and revisited The Dundies earlier today because I feel like that's the first episode that really stands out in my mind.
Wow, to me, it's
some of those
sexual harassment
episodes are.
I think it's the second episode of season 2.
Yeah, that was the next episode. Yeah. Dundies was the premiere of season 2.
Was it? No. Really?
I literally rewatched it hours ago. I'm aware of what order it was in. It's interesting. Season 1, I think, probably better in hindsight. Like, Diversity Day is in there. Some other good ones. But, you know, one of the big things that happened is I think they changed the tone a little bit based on Steve Carell's success in The 40-Year-Old Virgin that summer.
I mean, so Steve Carell became a star that offseason.
Oh, yeah. Like, he was so much bigger than just the guy who was doing Even Steven with Stephen Colbert, who the Colbert Report also did.
Really? In 2005?
Yeah.
Wow.
Big year for Stevens, who used to be correspondents on The Daily Show. The thing is, though, I mean, they softened Michael Scott, but rewatching The Office now, it seems really mean-spirited to
me. Does it? God, you're always so anti-The Office.
I'm not anti The Office. I'm anti the last season of The Office. It's just, I don't know if that's a change.
Not
totally
the last
TV
season got a little bit better, but there's one right before that that's just awful.
The Pam Jim stuff? Ugh. Not part of my Office canon.
I mean, really, when Michael Scott leaves, The Office is over. We all know that.
Correct.
It's the James Spader period we want no business with. And also Will Ferrell. Somehow they managed to make Will Ferrell seem bad. But I think season 8 might be the worst Office season.
That's not a rankings I want to do. So also debuting that year in the fall, How I Met Your Mother. A show that I didn't get into for a few years, but then became one of my all-time favorite.
Yeah, I didn't watch it.
Television programs.
Man, 2006. Well, I'm going to save it for 2006. I want to talk about The Office next season. of let's remember some years.
Season, huh? All right. So the other show that debuted in the summer of 2005, one that I did not get into for like 6 years, but still had plenty of seasons to come. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
It's still on the air, right?
Oh, yeah.
Man.
Yeah, they just finished a season.
Good
recently.
God. That is wild.
You know what else is still on the air that debuted in 2005? Grey's Anatomy.
Really? It's still on the air?
Grey's Anatomy started, we sent them, the Sonics marketing department sent them some Sonics gear to like have in the background of someone's
wow,
apartment.
They outlasted the Sonics by the a air. Long time.
By so much.
I remember the Colbert Report debuting now, right? Because we all like Stephen Colbert from our limited understanding of who he was from the Even Stevens and as a field reporter for the Daily Show, which really, I mean, we haven't talked about the Daily Show enough. Like, Daily Show was central to a lot of the things that happened in comedy in the early 2000s.
Yes.
Because it's, you know, it's not just these two. There's generations of reporters beyond that. And like I mentioned, like, America the Book was a big deal in the it was a number one bestseller in 2004 or whatever. But, like, I remember watching the Colbert Report and really being like, what is this, you know? Like,
yeah, because it was very different than what he had been doing previously. I think
I don't know what he had been doing, but like the Stephen Colbert character as like right-wing news media host, it was fucking brilliant in 2005.
It was a time that was ripe for that sort of thing, as most of them are.
So that, I mean, it was like the first, I mean, I think the entire run of the Colbert Report, like, it was, the whole thing was pretty brilliant what they were doing and had put together, and how it felt, it was like, the whole thing was like a big in-joke, basically.
Also in movies that year, Wedding Crashers.
Man, God, did we love Wedding Crashers and the 40-year-old version.
We sure did. Yes. I feel like Wedding Crashers probably higher rewatchability than the 40-year-old version.
I cannot, well, I don't know about that, but I cannot talk about accoutrement.
Agreed.
By the time I did all that, I had to get rid of it.
But I can't talk about Meatloaf without thinking of
Meatloaf.
That.
Meatloaf. Oh, my God. When Will Ferrell comes in Wedding Crashers, and then he's at the funeral at the very end, like, God, this was peak Will Ferrell.
Great moment. Also that year, the Star Wars prequel trilogy wrapped up with Revenge of the
Sith.
Okay,
so I still stand for Revenge of the Sith. I actually think it's the best Star Wars movie ever.
oh, boy.
No, I don't know about that. It is definitely the best of the non-original trilogy Star Wars movies to me. It's better than any of the sequels, and it's obviously better than any of the other prequels. But, like, the last, like, hour of Revenge of the Sith is excellent. It is like just boom, 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 one after another. Like, I mean, say what you will about the process for Anakin changing to Darth Vader or whatever. Like, it happens over like two conversations, and he's just like, boom, I'm Darth Vader. But the way that the whole like plot by Palpatine was played and it comes together at the end of Revenge of the Sith, it's just like, damn, that's good. And then you see him get the helmet on at the very end, and like Luke and Leia being born to these futuristic droids, which didn't exist all of a sudden like 30 years later. There's a lot of questions, but like the battle between Anakin and Obi-Wan to end Revenge of the Sith, this is a good movie. Like, people don't want to admit it, but right halfway through this movie, like, they get rid of all of the most annoying parts of all the prequels, and you're just like, let's roll, right? Like, it took so long for them to get to the point of like, it's on, and then they do, and they have one half of one good movie for all the sequels. But like, it is so good. It is still totally rewatchable. To me, a film that also, I mean, there's others that are big or whatever that weren't huge to me. I was still a little bit indie film in 2005. I remember going to see, which this felt so indie in 2005, Noah Baumbach's The Squid and the Whale in the theater. And we had to go to like a theater around UW, right? It's like, had to travel to...
Who was we?
Not you and me. You didn't know who the fuck Noah Baumbach was in 2005.
I'm planning to watch Squid and the Whale at some point here, because I watched Marriage Story a couple weeks ago.
But also, I remember going in IMAX to... I had never... Squid and the Whale. Dude, Bridges in 3D. His beard just in 3D. Haunting stuff. Going in IMAX to see Batman Begins, though. Where, like, again... Batman Begins is still my favorite of the Christopher Nolan Batman movies because I had no expectations for it. Like, I had zero interest in going to go see a Batman movie. It was like, I wasn't reading reviews of movies in 2005, right? Like, I guess I don't know if I am now either, but like, Jan was like, come watch Batman Begins in IMAX with me. And I'm like, I'm fine, whatever. And then sitting there and just like, enthralled the entire movie, where I was like, what the fuck? I was like, this is a Batman movie? Because I knew nothing about the like Batman as a character before then, because of how bad the movies of our like early childhood were, right? Like, we were a little bit too young to catch the maybe good parts of the original Batman films that came out in the late 80s, early 90s. You know, it's like I have a vague memory of Danny DeVito as the Penguin, but mostly it was like Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, which were legitimately bad movies. So the Nolan reboot, we had no idea who Christopher Nolan was, didn't care. And seeing that and just like how this is very much like middle-aged white dude thing, but being like, this is so serious and dense. It was like the villains weren't over the top. Scarecrow is the main villain, and I suppose Ra's al Ghul, but he doesn't really show up too much until the very end. But like, those are not, this is not the Joker, right? This isn't fucking Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze. This isn't Jim Carrey. It was like, this is a serious movie that's happening. And watching that, like, I was just like watching that in IMAX. It was one of those moments where I was like, I went into this movie expecting nothing at all and left caring about Batman for the rest of my life.
Anything else in 2005?
Well, you can suck at Jan. because... because I got into UW that year and moved out of the house. Me and Katie driving around like Wedgwood, Northgate area, looking for places to live. And then finally ending up in a house that was like massive house for $1,200 a month rent. And I even paid less because Katie had the bigger room. So I didn't pay an equal share. I think I paid $385 in rent.
and very little in heat. Apparently.
Just nothing. Discovering like, food on the Ave a little bit, not as much as I wish I would have. And like, we went to that shitty Chinese place that was on like 105th all the time.
That amazing Chinese place.
It was just like, this was the year that for me, and probably for you also, because you're about 3 years behind on everything. started like transitioning to becoming a more of an independent adult. Was 2005. I moved out of our childhood home for the first time ever. So, you were still living there. Were you?
I was at that point. Yes.
It's all right. I moved but back. Previously.
Yeah, I had previously not lived there. All right, let's return briefly to the present. One thing we wanted to shout out. Actually, this is part of history, but not necessarily 2005. The History of the Seattle Mariners, Torchtown video series with John Boyce and Alex Rubenstein has been quite fun. You caught up on this over last weekend?
Yeah. This was really fun. I've watched through the first couple episodes. I think the most recent one is the 95 Mariners, which I haven't watched just yet. But like,
what strictly focuses on the Mariners-Yankees series, the most recent episode.
They get to the one-game playoff at the end of the Griffey episode. So... I fell asleep after watching the second episode before the third was out, And then I woke up at like 4 a.m. with YouTube still on, and it was game 5 of the 95 ALDS. It was just playing in full. And I was like, I was like, all right, buckle up. It's 4 a.m. I was like, I guess I'm watching the last 3 innings of the 95 ALDS. It is thrilling to watch now. It was pretty crazy stuff, but
it's probably more thrilling to watch then.
It was more scary to watch then. Now you know that there's a positive outcome. This series is awesome. Like, just the whole tone where they're coming at it. It's a documentary where it's like, it's not cheesy, and it's not like, they're not Mariners fans as far as I know, right?
No.
Which is kind of awesome to have a documentary about the Mariners history from people who aren't, they're not too indebted to the Mariners, right? These aren't Jose Lopez people. We're like, there's sort of an out.
Sorry, there's not a Jose Lopez people.
But I'm saying this isn't like, I was raised in Seattle and so I love these people unequivocally, right? It's just like, this is a crazy franchise and has been a crazy franchise. And so it's fun to look back on.
Yeah, it'll probably get less fun after 95.
Oh, will it? No, probably because they'll be pro each row.
Coming up this Friday, the WNBA draft will be held remotely. The first big event to occur with everybody at home following social distancing. The Storm hold the number 11 overall pick in the first round. A selection of a few players who have been mocked to them. Michelle Vopel, my ESPN colleague, has them taking Ruthie Hebert from Oregon. High Post Hoops has them going for UConn point guard Crystal Dangerfield, and Swish Appeal also has them going for a point guard Tyasha Harris of South Carolina.
Okay, so they have the 11th pick. Did they trade their first round pick down?
Yeah, they traded down as part of the sign and trade that they picked up Morgan Tuck from Connecticut earlier in the offseason. And so the other thing the Storm have going is they've got basically close to a full roster. We still haven't heard whether they're going to bring over last year's first-round pick, Australian Ezzy Megbegor. If she does come over, that would really be 12 players you would expect to make the roster. They might cut someone unexpectedly, but they may again try to stash this pick because there's not a clear roster path to a roster spot.
Okay.
Some sad news from the XFL last week as they announced that they are suspending operations and laid off their employees. Currently no plans for the XFL to return in 2021. Feels like the league did everything in its power pretty well, and just like so much of society had those best laid plans undone by this pandemic.
I think what we've learned the last two off seasons is that a football league that is not the NFL is probably not going to be financially viable. But I
don't think that is the lesson we learned from this year, because I mean, we just don't know. Like, they didn't get a chance.
They didn't. But B, there is demand for football outside of the NFL.
Correct. A lot of people are interested.
So yeah, I've seen people tweet about this, but like, if the NFL could take on a more development role with a spring/summer league, and it could have the financial umbrella of the NFL itself, I think a league could be extremely successful.
But why would you want young players to develop? What benefit could there possibly be in that?
Oh yeah, good point. Also, 2005, Lazy Sunday. Come on.
Oh, was that 2005?
That's a chronic.
That is close enough.
Snuck in at the very end of 2005. That's the beginning of SNL Digital Shorts, I believe.
That's one of those where I feel like, I don't know if I remember missing it and just like reading about it on the internet the next day and actually being able to watch it at that point because the internet existed.
Barely. Just barely. It was the second ever digital short. The first two happened in 2005. The first one was Lettuce definitely featuring Will Forte. Where they're just sitting around eating. I didn't realize that was the first one.
Eating lettuce, yeah. I mean, that's like the first really viral SNL sketch in the internet era, I feel like.
It transformed SNL, that sketch.
So speaking of the NFL and the Seahawks, mostly in waiting mode, continue as they continue to wait out a decision from Jadeveon Clowney. A couple of minor roster moves. They re-signed guard Jordan Simmons, which had been rumored, as well as cornerback Nico Thorpe. You know, both kind of minor of their own free agents, but still no word on Clowney. It'll be interesting to see if the NFL draft coming up in a week and a half spurs any movement there.
Very strange. I think we'd seen online a version of the offer to Clowney, which, in my opinion, looked offensive.
I don't know if they believe that contracts could be offensive, but it did not seem commensurate with his abilities.
I guess the reality is the Seahawks probably know more about Jadeveon Clowney than we do, and
I don't know how convinced I am that that's their current offer.
Is there a chance that he could just be way more hurt than we realize?
Sure. There's a chance.
I really just don't see any other explanation for this.
Again, I'm going to go back to the beginning of this podcast. Never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by incompetence. And running back just got $16 million a year on an extension, despite the enormous amount of evidence we have that big contracts for running backs are disastrously bad.
He's more of a Reggie Bush-style running back. He's more of like a receiver-slash-running back.
I prefer to think of him as more of a David Johnson.
Oh, God. But, God. We should end the podcast, but why does every terrible trade involving the Texans also have to involve the NFC West?
I mean, you know, I think what the NFC West teams would say, and the 49ers don't benefit from the Texans, right?
They only benefited from swindling the Colts.
That was only fair to those teams after the Seahawks got Clowney so cheaply that they get someone as well, or in the Rams' case, a draft pick. One other bit of Seahawks news, though. A new Pete Carroll podcast during the quarantine period, limited series, announced at the Ringer that he's co-hosting along with Warriors coach Steve Kerr, called Flying Coach. So listen to the first episode of that today. Probably pretty familiar if you've read Win Forever and are familiar with the Pete Carroll backstory, but you know, some interesting stuff about Kerr coming up to training camp with the Seahawks in 2014 after he first took the Warriors job, and you know, trying to learn from Pete Carroll and Pete Carroll learning from Kerr.
Yeah,
as well.
It's real pyramid core.
Yes, it is. Pete Carroll did talk about the similarity between, or maybe it was Kerr that brought that up. But Carroll went with it. The similarity between the Win Forever philosophy and parenting. So, you know, the people who are believers in Win Forever parenting, like you used to be at one point, definitely will be interested
win
in that.
Win Forever philosophy and parenting.
Yeah.
Am I interested in the Win Forever philosophy when it comes to parenting?
I feel like
absolutely
you are.
Absolutely, I am. Okay. It involves having your child tell you to shut up all the time. Oh my God, Obi, leave. What are you doing here, Obi? And your child calling you Obi for Obi-Wan Kenobi. Because they fucking stand Revenge of the Sith.
I think that's a very different form of parenting. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Question for you. Did you watch the SNL at home?
I did.
What do you think?
Pretty hit or miss.
It was like they said that they were only going to do it one time, which to me is like, couldn't you do this every week?
Yeah. I don't know if you can do it. You should do it every week, but like every couple weeks or so, I think.
Why not every week?
It just probably takes more time to edit.
You think so? I thought the Zoom sketch was like, that would be just a normal sketch if they were in office or whatever.
I thought they should have done more. I thought those were better than the individual sketches generally. The ones where they had multiple people involved.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really funny idea, but I don't know about the exact execution of it.
It was fine. It was like, I think they went too far or whatever, but like, it was funny for a second. The thing where Mikey Day is a Twitch streamer who keeps getting shot, I thought was really funny.
that I really enjoyed.
I thought that was good. Like, really, the whole thing kind of worked. The like cuts that they had with Tom Hanks were really strange. Where I was like, why do you need to have these weird cuts?
I agree.
And same with Larry David. Where I was like, Bernie Sanders. But I was like, why are there these weird cuts? Like, he could do this straight through. I thought that was pretty strange. But like, Weekend Update, I thought worked in general.
I thought not having an audience was a real tough, because like, they had the virtual audience, but you need someone to sell the jokes, as Tom Hanks I think said.
It wasn't quite as good, but it wasn't necessarily bad.
I mean, the end of Weekend Update was amazing.
But no, I thought it's like almost, it was like half sort of you pull back the curtain of kind of what this is, right? It makes the whole thing feel less professional in a good way.
The other thing that was noticeable is like, they don't have SNL providing props. And...
oh yeah, like the Ginsburg thing. It's like she looked a lot less like Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I mean, I thought that was fine because it's more about the spirit of it. I think they spent too much time on that. But like, not having a backdrop or anything for a lot of the sketches was funny. I did appreciate Chris Martin putting the whatever like entrance to trains above where he was.
Did he? I fast forwarded through all of Chris Martin. I mean, I fast forward through all the musical guests, no matter what, even if I like them, because I just don't watch musical guests. But yeah, Pete Davidson being there doing the Drake song, I thought that was pretty good. I thought the whole thing all together was like, this is pretty good. The only reason that it wouldn't make sense to do it every week is that, which I guess this is maybe an issue with all of SNL, is like, it's like there's so much better humor about this, you know, than what they're doing, but like, that's probably the case no matter what in modern times on the internet.
I mean, it was good for them to be able to like get jokes off on some things like Tiger King.
Yeah. I feel like I would watch every week if they did it every week.
Yeah, I would too.
I mean, they're not going to be able to get together anytime soon. So they're going to have to figure out doing something like this.